From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Later today, President Trump is expected to announce a new executive order requiring a question on citizenship for the upcoming census. We'll talk about the likely legal challenge to the president's action. We'll also be focused today on new legislation creating a wildfire relief fund in California. Where will that money come from? We'll hear all about it. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Things heating up here in Southern California. What's going to be a warm day? Coming up a little bit later this hour, we'll talk about three different couples involved in a scandal at an L.A. area fertility clinic with the implementation of embryos that didn't belong to the couple where the mother ended up giving birth. We'll talk about the legal ramifications as well as what degree of oversight there is for fertility clinics doing in vitro fertilization and implantation. That's coming up a little bit later. But first, as you just heard on NPR News, President Trump is expected later today to announce executive action that would include a question about citizenship on the 2020 census. The president tweeted this morning that he planned the announcement at a news conference after a White House social media summit. Joining us to talk about what we know about the expected announcement, White House correspondent and associate editor of Politico, Anita Kumar. Anita, good to have you with us this morning. First of all, do we know much more about the details than what the president tweeted?
We don't know a lot about how he will do this, and people are really looking to see that language on how he would do this executive action, because you can bet that they will take it to court immediately. But he hasn't indicated, and we're still waiting for some of that language.
Now, what sort of latitude does the president have after the Supreme Court decision of a couple of weeks ago, which seemed at least temporarily to close the door on the question?
Well, so the Supreme Court said that they left the door open for him to try to do this. What they said was the reason that he gave, or that the administration gave, wasn't a good reason. I think they used the word contrived. They thought it was sort of a made-up reason just to get this on there. So what we're waiting to see is sort of what the new rationale is. What will they say? Why will they say they need to do this?
And then this would open up the door, presumably, for a legal challenge to the stated justification for the executive order, or whether the president even has the right to do that. What would be the course of challenging it? Where would advocates go?
Well, it's a really good question. The answer is we're not positive, and here's why. There already are lawsuits pending in different places, including Maryland and San Francisco and New York, about this issue in the first place. There were other lawsuits, not just the one that made it to the Supreme Court. So there, those in those places, particularly in Maryland, they're doing discovery, trying to find out some more information about why the administration wanted this. So presumably it would go to a lower court and then make it up to the Supreme Court. But the administration has indicated it might go straight back to the Supreme Court and ask for sort of a clarification on what they're doing. So we're not sure which path they'll take, but but it's pretty obvious that some of these people that are opposed to this question being on there would say, no, they're not. They shouldn't be able to take it straight to the Supreme Court. Obviously, the reason the administration wants to do that is they want to be very quick about this. They don't want to have it go through all the court system before it gets to the Supreme Court.
We're talking with Politico's Anita Kumar, who's White House correspondent and associate editor for the Politico publication. We're talking about the expected announcement from President Trump later today that he's taking executive action requiring a citizenship question be asked on the 2020 census. Anita, where is the census at in terms of its creation and its rollout to Americans to be filled out?
The administration has told the court that they needed this case expedited, the one that went to the Supreme Court, because they had a June deadline for starting the paperwork, starting to print the questionnaires for people, Americans, to get next year. So, you know, there's a little confusion here. If they're saying the deadline has already passed, how can they go ahead and implement that? And a judge might say to them, well, how can you do this now? They are, they have started printing those questionnaires already. They said they went ahead and did that, and there is no question on citizenship on there right now.
All right. Anita, anything to add before we let you go about how D.C. is responding to this or what we're hearing in the past couple of hours from advocacy groups?
Sure. I mean, we're hearing a lot from Democrats and critics, advocacy groups who say that this is going to create a constitutional crisis, that he doesn't have the authority to do this. And as you would expect, that they will immediately get ready to challenge this in court.
All right. Anita, thanks so much. Good to talk with you. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks so much.
Anita Kumar, White House correspondent, associate editor of Politico. She covers the Trump presidency for Politico as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and you can expect in-depth coverage of the executive action when it's expected to be announced later today. It'll be on All Things Considered with Nick Roman. A Glendale couple is suing a mid-city L.A. fertility clinic, claiming that the couple's embryo was mistakenly implanted in a New York woman who gave birth to the Glendale couple's son, as well as a second boy belonging to yet another couple. The lawsuit filed by Annie and Ashot Manukian describes an alleged in vitro fertilization mix-up by CHA Fertility Center in Los Angeles. Three different couples are involved. The suit was filed yesterday in L.A. County Superior Court. The language in the suit states that what Annie and Ashot discovered, much to their horror, was that their son had been stolen from them when he was still an embryo and implanted into a stranger that later became his birth mother. Now, the birth mother in New York believed she was carrying twins made from her and her husband's genetic material. This according to the lawsuit. Genetic testing confirmed the two infants were not related to the couple and weren't related to each other. The Queens woman and her husband filed a separate medical malpractice and negligence lawsuit in federal court in Brooklyn last week. The Manukians here in Glendale went through a court fight before they got custody of their son. According to the court filing, they're seeking unspecified compensatory and punitive damages. Officials at CHA Fertility Center in Mid-City Los Angeles have not responded to the Associated Press with any comments. Now, Annie Manukian, by the way, in the lawsuit says she was mistakenly implanted with at least one embryo of a stranger when she thought the embryo resulted from her and her husband's genetic material. But that implantation in Annie Manukian did not result in a successful pregnancy. So this raises a number of questions: how these sorts of errors can be made at fertility clinics. What is the degree of oversight that is provided to these medical facilities? And how frequently are these kinds of errors made? We have three guests who will be joining us for the course of the next several minutes to talk about how the clinics are overseen. With me first, from University of San Diego, Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Health Law and Bioethics, Dove Fox. Professor Fox, thank you for being with us.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
You've just written a new book, very much on point, Birth Rights and Wrongs, How Medicine and Technology Are Remaking Reproduction and the Law. Do we have any sense of how frequently errors like this are made?
We don't, except that they're probably more common than you might think. You know, there are a couple reported cases just like this in New York, one in 2000, another one in 2007, and several that are relatively similar involving mix-ups of sperm, eggs, and embryos. But there's no body that tracks or reports or records mistakes like these in the United States, by contrast to other developed countries.
So what are the ways that other countries oversee this versus the U.S.?
Well, in the United Kingdom, there is a federal agency that licenses and monitors all fertility clinics. So this agency goes and visits every clinic to make sure that each individual procedure they propose to carry out abides by the latest in medical science and technology, that the training and equipment is up to standard and best practices. We have nothing like that here in the United States. There's no federal or state body that oversees fertility clinics, let alone sperm banks or egg vendors.
If it's a labeling problem, let's just say hypothetically that you had the mislabeling in the laboratory, and that's what led to this. Is that something that, you know, in the moment when regulators aren't there, would necessarily be caught?
So there are a number of problems that might have led to a switch or mix-up like this, and you're right, labeling is one of them. You know, a number of these facilities use, I mean, even pencil and paper, if you can believe it, that can get smudged and misread to link the individual to the sample. But there are other techniques that are far more reliable, like electronic barcoding, but they'd have to be required and checked. And that is the sort of thing that could be regulated. In theory, the regulation is a double-edged sword, though. You can certainly maintain more reliable standards for safety, labeling, storage. There are any number of mistakes that could be prevented or at least made less likely or frequent with the appropriate precautions. On the other hand, some worry that with regulation comes government oversight over which people or what sorts of people are allowed to become parents.
We're talking with Dove Fox, who's professor of law at the University of San Diego and author of the new book, Birth Rights and Wrongs, How Medicine and Technology Are Remaking Reproduction and the Law. Also with us from the UC Irvine School of Medicine, associate professor of psychiatry and director of the medical ethics program at UCI, Aaron Cariotti. Dr. Cariotti, thank you for being with us. UC Irvine was at the center of a huge fertility medicine scandal going back, it must be almost 25 years ago, involving the two physicians who headed the UC Irvine Fertility Center. Take us back to what happened there.
Yeah, that's right. This was back in 1995, and there were two very highly recruited assisted reproductive technology physicians that were involved. It was Dr. Ash and Balmaceda, who had pioneered a fertilization technique known as GIFT, gamete intrafallopian transfer. So they were highly regarded. They were at a major university medical center, and a researcher in their lab discovered and blew the whistle on a disaster that makes the current headline. I don't want to minimize the current headline, but it was at least as disastrous and involved actually far more people. And what had happened there was that eggs and embryos had been swapped from healthy women and given to other women without either of their consent. And so 15 babies were born to women who were not their mothers in ways that were, I suppose, analogous to the case that's currently in the headlines. And parents discovered, also similarly to this case, that they had biological children out there that they could not locate or contact. And at that point, they had no sort of parental rights over those children. And this case seems to have not been accidental. This was a deliberate attempt to increase this clinic's success rates. And people had sniffed that something was amiss for quite a while, that the reported success rates in this clinic were much higher than the national average. And, you know, people were asking very good questions about why they were succeeding far more often than other clinics. And it had to do with the fact that they were selecting the most healthy gametes and the most healthy embryos to be implanted, even if those didn't belong to the intentional parents. And so when the Orange County Register broke this story, the two doctors fled to South America to avoid criminal charges. Dr. Ash went to Mexico and his associate went to Argentina. And the really strange thing, Larry, was that at the time, even though everyone recognized that this was a complete disaster, there was no existing law against their actions. It was as though the legal and regulatory scheme had not sort of caught up to where the technology was. And so they ended up being indicted on things like mail fraud and tax evasion. They were never extradited back to the United States, and so they didn't face trial. But the university ended up paying about $25 million out in settlements to over 100 couples, and there were like 140 or so lawsuits in this disaster. So I look at the present case, which is also obviously disastrous and makes headlines and kind of outrages everyone. And, you know, I think we can ask the question, is this case that we see this week a kind of canary in the coal mine? Is it a signal that something might be amiss in terms of the regulation of this industry? Or is this case an outlier, you know, a kind of bizarre fluke? And I think one difficulty with the sort of one-time fluke interpretation is that this isn't the first time that this kind of thing has happened at a fertility clinic, even here in California.
Aaron, when we come back, I want to ask you about what, if anything, from an ethical standard or regulatory guideline followed the Balmaceda Ash scandal at UC Irvine Fertility Clinic nearly 25 years ago. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Cariotti. He's Associate Professor of Psychiatry and directs the UC Irvine School of Medicine Medical Ethics Program. We'll be back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later, a giant of American conservatism, George Will, his new book, The Conservative Sensibility. You've seen him for years on television programs, providing his commentary from a conservative perspective. He's been a very strong critic of President Trump. He joins us to talk about politics and maybe a little bit of baseball. He's a huge baseball fan, prominently featured in Ken Burns' baseball documentary series as well. George Will coming up in a few minutes. But right now, we're taking a look at a Southern California Fertility Center, CHA Fertility, in Mid-City Los Angeles. Annie and Ashot Manukyan of Glendale allege in a lawsuit filed this week that there was an in vitro mix-up and that they had the embryo from a stranger implanted in Annie, and that there was a couple in New York that ended up with the Manukyan's embryo, and that the mix-up involved three separate families, and at least two lawsuits have been filed. It raises the question of what sort of oversight, protocols, ethical guidelines exist in reproductive medicine to try and avoid these kinds of things so traumatic for the couples involved. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Cariotti of UC Irvine School of Medicine and an ethicist as well. We were talking about the scandal nearly 25 years ago at the UC Irvine Fertility Center. Did anything change in terms of ethical guidelines or the law after that?
So certainly there was a robust response from the university itself, the institution where this happened, shut down the fertility clinic, and they've been sufficiently wary that they haven't reopened one since then, although there have been talks of potentially doing so. But in terms of state and federal regulations, Larry, it's, again, kind of surprising that not a whole lot was put in place after that. So the CDC does collect data from about 440 clinics in the U.S., but the data is pretty minimal. There are probably 5 to 10% of fertility clinics, small operations, that don't report to the CDC that are out there and in business. And beyond that, the states and the federal government don't regulate things like, for example, how many children may be conceived from one donor. In the case of gamete donors, male gamete donors, how many embryos may be placed in a woman at a time. There are still no laws or hard and fast regulations for that. So we may remember another case out of California, the so-called Octomom, right, the woman who gave birth to 8 children, which caused quite a stir. That doctor ended up facing disciplinary actions in terms of his medical license, right? So the state medical board did not take kindly to that action. But again, in doing that particular case, the reproductive endocrinologist involved did not actually break any laws of the state of California or any federal regulations. So I have friends and colleagues involved in the ethics of assisted reproductive technologies, and some of them would disagree with me on this point, but I'm in the camp that believes that this industry in the United States is still too unregulated. And I agree with Professor Fox that, if we look to other countries, we can see some forms of regulation that may be sensible, maybe good for us to think about here.
Let me bring into our conversation from the USC Keck School of Medicine, Dr. Kristen Bendixson, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology. She performs IVF procedures and works at the USC Fertility Clinic. Dr. Bendixson, thank you for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Do you take issue with the view that this is underregulated?
Well, we have lots of regulations in place, and we do have to submit our data to SART. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine has a practice committee, and they actually do have a committee opinion that does speak directly to this, in that they say that laboratories must employ and maintain a system that provides for proper patient identification throughout the process. But as your other guests have mentioned, there aren't specific laws and rules and regulations that define how that needs to be done. I think obviously this is a tragic event, and the problem in what I see is that there are no amount of rules and regulations that can truly overcome human error. And I think every IVF clinic is truly doing their best to minimize these types of mistakes. These should be never happen situations. This would be my worst nightmare as a practitioner to have this happen to one of our patients. Most clinics, and are taking multiple measures to ensure that something like this doesn't happen.
At USC, at the in vitro clinic there, how do you make sure that you're tracking everything in a way that is going to make it hopefully impossible to implant the wrong embryo?
That's a great question. And part of this speaks to why it's so hard to regulate it, and that every IVF clinic uses different equipment. Their labs are set up in different ways. And while it is sensible to maybe say that you have to have some system set in place, it is hard to dictate what that system would be. There are many things that we do at our office to make sure that this never happens. Just a few things to give you some ideas is, for example, if an embryo is in a dish, that dish is labeled not just one way, and it's labeled two different ways. It might have a barcode sticker on it, but it is also going to be written on that dish as well, and you can write it with certain types of pens. You can actually etch it into the dish. There's different ways to do it. And the identifier is not just one. It's not the name. It's the name of the patient, the date of birth of the patient, the unique identifying medical record number of that patient. If you have someone who is going to have their embryos thawed out that were previously frozen, you have two sets of eyes. So we have two embryologists that look not only at the order from the physician that has all of those unique identifying features on them, but they are looking at the straw that the embryos are stored in and looking at both labels on that straw to make sure that they are thawing out indeed the correct embryo.
Do you feel like you have a sense of the frequency of major errors like this, as is alleged at CHA Fertility, or do you feel like you don't have enough exposure to what's happening in other fertility clinics to be able to really gauge how much of a one-off this is or isn't?
These things happen. This is not the first case, but they're really rare. I mean, there are 400,000 IVF cycles performed every year, over 8 million babies from IVF, and these are you know, few, but there are more than one, obviously. There are a few handfuls of cases like this. These cases are so tragic and large that I think that most of them will make it into the media, and they're not going to be things that are necessarily going to be silenced. Is it possible that there are other situations where this has happened before and we don't know about it? The answer is yes. But I do think that this is very rare. So I think it's important for patients to know that this is an extremely rare event.
And do you agree with Dr. Cariotti that it would be beneficial to have a more regulated area here, as is done in other countries? Or do you feel like that would in some way hamstring the work you do?
I actually think what he said was really great, and that I think that, you know, yes, could regulations help in some way? I think that the really great clinics already have great systems in place to prevent this from happening. And even in those clinics, obviously, there is human error. I think that no matter how many regulations that you have, there are potentially going to be maybe those bad apples, those rare clinics, that they may have systems in place, but they don't follow them 100% of the time. And so they could have some overarching agency come visit their clinic, and it still looks like they're doing an okay job. And then they still, as soon as that visitor leaves, then they kind of go back to what their norm is, which is not doing a great job. I think that that is probably a really rare clinic that is going to be like that. So I think most of the clinics are doing everything they can to make sure that something like this doesn't happen.
Dr. Bendixson, thank you very much. So good to have you with us. I understand right before you got on with us, you'd been thawing an egg for the fertility clinic at USC. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. That's Dr. Kristen Bendixson, assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the USC Keck School of Medicine. Our thanks to UC Irvine School of Medicine professor Aaron Cariotti, who directs the medical ethics program at UCI, and Dove Fox, University of San Diego, professor of law and director there of the Center for Health Law and Bioethics. We'll continue to cover this case of the Glendale couple suing a Los Angeles-based CHA fertility center for what the Manoukians claim was a mix-up in implantation of embryos involving a New York couple and another third couple as well, where the embryos were mixed up. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. George Will with us shortly. His new book, The Conservative Sensibility. Maybe we'll even get some baseball questions in with Mr. Will. That to come right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up in our next hour, Governor Gavin Newsom backing legislation that would give some relief to the electricity companies in the wake of the huge California wildfires. Consumer groups pushing back against it. We'll talk about pros and cons of the legislation next hour. But right now, my pleasure to welcome George Will, who first came to my attention in 1976. I was a freshman in college, and as a Newsweek subscriber, I eagerly read George Will's back page column. I've kept reading his work for more than 40 years. I'm glad he's still at it, whether writing about political history, baseball, or the nature of conservatism. George Will provides a tremendous amount of analysis to consider. He received the Pulitzer Prize for Commentary in 1977. He's written numerous books in addition to his long-standing syndicated column and regular TV appearances now on NBC and MSNBC. And George Will's new book is The Conservative Sensibility. Mr. Will, we welcome you to Air Talk.
Thank you. I only write about politics to support my baseball habit.
That sounds right. I'm not sure what conservatism means anymore relative to politics. The conservative goal, smaller government, higher bar for passing regulations, balancing revenues with spending. Those seem like low priorities for both parties today. What happened?
Well, first of all, the American political class from Elizabeth Warren on the left to Ted Cruz on the right is more united by class interest than it is divided by ideology. And their principal class interest is in running large deficit all the time. We right now are running a $1 trillion deficit at more than full employment and reasonably brisk economic growth. The political class wants to give the American people a dollar's worth of government, charge them 80 cents for it, borrow the rest. The public loves it. The political class loves it because it makes big government artificially cheap. And so we just merrily go along, assuming that the bill will never come due.
And is there any chance that a candidate who talks about the bill that's coming down the road can be elected to office? Or is that just run contrary to people's self-interest to take that in?
Not only won't be elected to office, it'll be run out of town. The country is resolutely opposed to anyone telling them the truth about the arithmetic, the basic arithmetic of public life. This is part of the reason why you said you were in some doubt, and lots of us are, about the real meaning of conservatism right now, which is why I wrote the book.
We're talking with George Will. If you have questions for him about his new book, The Conservative Sensibility, in which he lays out what he sees as the roots of conservatism going back to the American Revolution as expressed through the Constitution and evolving, of course, in the two centuries since, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You go back to the founders, and what do you see as their clearly stated conservative ideals?
There are three of them. First is the idea of natural rights. That is, that our rights pre-exist government. They do not come from government. Governments are instituted to use the verb in the second paragraph of the Declaration, to secure our rights. That natural rights are those that history and experience have shown to be essential to the flourishing of creatures with our nature. The second premise of the founders was that human nature is real and durable, that we are not, that is, simply creatures that acquire whatever culture we find ourselves situated in. When you deny that, you open the great dangerous political project of manipulating the culture in order to manipulate the nature of humanity itself. And third, the great belief in the separation of powers so that government will be strong enough to protect our rights and not so strong as to threaten them.
Taking the third one first, you point out that Teddy Roosevelt was really the one who expanded the power of the presidency. And so what was the response that had to come after that to try and rebalance the three branches of government?
Actually, I'm still waiting for the response. Woodrow Wilson came after Teddy Roosevelt and supplied a theory for Roosevelt's practice. And his theory, which is the essence of progressivism, is that the separation of powers is now an anachronism. It was all very well when there were only 4 million Americans, 80% of them living within 20 miles of Atlantic Tidewater. But now, said Roosevelt, and this said Wilson, and this is sort of the great progressive non sequitur, now that we're a great continental nation with a complex society, government must be comparably complex and ambitious and nimble in intervening in the society. That's a non sequitur because if you believe, as I and Friedrich Hayek and basically conservatives do, the more complicated society is, the less government knows about it, the less government knows relative to what there is to be known, and that markets, which are the great generators of information, the aggregators of information, are much more efficient at allocating wealth and opportunity than government is.
Now, you do point out, though, that John Marshall, in expanding or reining in the power of the executive congressional branches, plays a very important role here in responding.
Yes, in my now 50 years in Washington, the biggest change of mind that I've undergone is this. I used to believe that judicial restraint and deference to the elected political popular branches of government was required. I now think that that is very often not deference but dereliction of the judicial duty to supervise democracy. My chapter on this in the book is called The Judicial Supervision of Democracy. James Madison, who's the hero of my book, really, said that we are going to have majority rule, but care must be taken that majority opinion is filtered and refined and slowed and deflected and expressed through representative institutions. If you want to know what conservatism is, it's the opposite of populism. populism believes in the direct translation of mass opinion through a plebiscitory presidency into governance, into a president who would say, for example, only I can fix it, as the current president said at the convention that nominated him in 2016. Conservatism believes that the people do not decide issues, they decide who will decide. That's the principle of representative government. And that once you have, as we now have under, after really 80 years of development under Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, and others, we now have a thoroughly marginalized Congress. People say just presidents have been usurping Congress's power. If only they had to usurp it. Congress has been all too willing to cede powers to the presidency, to divest itself of powers that it has no right to delegate. And it is my hope, and there's some evidence that this will happen, that the Supreme Court is now going to breathe life back into the non-delegation doctrine. Not since 1935 has the Supreme Court struck down an act of Congress as being an excessive delegation of legislative powers. I think they're going to start doing that again.
We're talking with George Will. His new book, The Conservative Sensibility. If you'd like to speak with him, you have questions for him about the nature of conservatism, where the Republican Party is today, traditionally the conservative party in America, though George Will would take issue with that. We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment on our AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And George Will, I guess if you were to write your hip-hop musical, it would be Madison, not Hamilton. Would be
what
the
a great idea.
Would be your answer to Lin-Manuel Miranda, 866-893-KPECC. Now, many younger urban Americans have become internationalists. They, you know, they've traveled widely. They see the European model of democratic socialism as in many ways preferable to the U.S. system. Now, given that such a strong social and intellectual trend, what sort of competitive opportunities do conservatives have in countering that appeal for younger urban Americans?
Let me dispute your premise that there is a strong surge of socialist opinion. I agree that young people are internationalists. I have a daughter at the moment in Rome and a son in Hong Kong, typical of their age cohort. But the same young people who express kind of warm feelings for the name socialism also express a robust skepticism of government. Well, you can't have both. Because whatever else socialism is, it is the government permeating the market to improve upon the market's allocation of capital, wealth, and opportunity. I do think that that conservatives must make, and in my book I do make, a robust defense of capitalism as a system that not only makes us better off, but which makes us better. That is, it enforces a kind of individualism, thrift, industriousness, deferral of gratification, and the spontaneous order of individuals contracting with one another to achieve their ends without resort to statism.
But in capitalism, you have people who don't compete so well. And the question is then, how does, whether it's government or some other societal force, come into play to try and help those who aren't able to as effectively compete, either because of external or internal forces? And what's the way that capitalism answers that emotional need?
Conservatism is not opposed to ameliorative government. Indeed, the beginnings of the welfare state on a large scale were in Bismarck's Germany. Bismarck's government, quite conservative, understood that it needed to have a social safety net in order to reconcile the working classes with the frictions, vicissitudes, exhilarations, but also frightening aspects of economic dynamism. So support for capitalism and for a social safety net grew up together.
I have a question related to this from a listener. I'll share it with George Will as we continue. We're listening to him talk about his new book, The Conservative Sensibility. We're taking your calls with your questions at 866-893-KPCC. I'll be back in just 1 minute. George Will with us on Air Talk. He comments on politics, social issues for NBC and MSNBC. For many years, he wrote an every other week column for Newsweek. Now we're talking with him about his new book, The Conservative Sensibility. I just want to digress for a moment because, you know, you've been a part of popular culture as well. In fact, you even made it into a mention in a Seinfeld episode. I can recount it, but I probably don't have it down as well as you do. Do you mind sharing it?
Well, yes. It's the first time my children ever took me seriously. I think it was Kramer who said that I was cute. I didn't know quite how to take that. But again, as I say, my children finally said, well, Dad's a serious person after all.
The friends are talking about it. I think it was how a man can be physically attractive to another man. You don't have to be gay. And so Kramer mentions you. And then I think it's George who, or maybe it's Elaine, who said, well, he is very smart. And Kramer said, well, I don't think he's that smart.
That sounds right.
Very funny.
And he's right.
That's a very funny bit. 866-893-KPCC has also been portrayed on Saturday Night Live. I don't know how you feel about that, but
it was terrific. It was George Will's sports machine. When I had a baseball book called Men at Work that was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 2 months, and they made great fun of me. It was very funny. It was Dana Carvey playing me.
Well, and who wouldn't want to have Dana Carvey portraying him? Let me go back to what we were just talking about with capitalism. Kevin in San Pedro called and said, you know, when we had the market implosion back in 2008, should it have been allowed to collapse, or did the government do the right thing and step in with a bailout?
The government emphatically did the right thing. The system was seizing up, and it's one thing to let Lehman Brothers go under. If all the counterparties to all our great banks had frozen up, we would have lost the financial system. There's nothing in conservatism says that government can't have measures for public health and safety, that government can't have a social safety net, or that government cannot, which after all does run the currency, cannot have do some regulation. I would point out, however, that I think the origin of the mortgage-based collapse of 2008 was a government program whereby the government, again, making the fatal conceit, to use Hayek's term, that it knew more than it did, decided that it knew more than the market did about how many people should be homeowners, and it began to support more and more marginal buyers in the purchase of mortgage, subprime mortgages and all that. So I think the crisis of 2008 was made in Washington.
Well, but do you think that then there's a role for government in limiting, you know, particularly what the big banks can do, putting restrictions on lending? Is all of this the role of government to avoid a catastrophic economic meltdown?
Certainly. And all the big banks have permanent federal presence in their buildings. They are heavily regulated. No one, again, wants a capitalism without some sense of public accountability. What worries conservatives is when the government goes way beyond protecting the public and begins to protect factions, when it becomes the plaything of interest groups. I think, for example, that Elizabeth Warren has a firm grip on half of the point. Her point, half of the point, is Washington is far too much the captive of intense, organized, confident, articulate, well-financed, and well-lawyered factions that know how to do what the economists call rent-seeking, that is, bending public power for private advantage. What mystifies me is that she then says, well, the solution is to make the government much bigger and much more active in allocating wealth and opportunity. All that does is make it even more the target of interest groups that capture it for rent-seeking purposes.
Bob in Thousand Oaks asks, has there ever been an economy running on the principles you describe, and how did it perform?
The closest we've had to unfettered capitalism was in the Gilded Age and after the Civil War, the last half of the 19th century. It had terrible excesses. It also, however, built the railroads, industrialized society, had economic growth robust enough that we could absorb the enormous and, I think, altogether beneficial flow of immigrants into our country. So even when it was at its most unregulated, capitalism was A, successful, and B, on balance, an excellent thing for the for absorbing the new diverse American public.
You've said Donald Trump's presidency has done more harm to the country than Richard Nixon's, that the Republican Party's become a cult of Trump. One of the things I think at work here is that Trump has been embraced by some because of the huge cultural divide in the country and because of his pugnacious approach. There are people who get emotional relief from that, and it feels good for them to feel like they've got a president who's fighting back against what they see as a damaging trend. Do you think that that is a significant part of the appeal of President Trump?
Yes, I think the manner, which I think is doing more lasting damage to the country than Nixon's surreptitious burglaries did. After all, Nixon's deeds were surreptitious. They did not pretend to be new norms. And once revealed, they were punished and we moved on. Mr. Trump is setting out, he's keeping his perverse campaign promise to overturn the norms of civility in our politics. You're quite right. Many of his supporters like him for his entertainment value, and it is cathartic to them because they think that they feel as though they're victims of America. For a long time, it was progressives and liberals who sort of harped on victimology. Now conservatives have got in on the game, and we have what I'd call crybaby conservatism. People saying the markets are mean to me, the media's mean to me, Hollywood, academia, they're all picking on me. It's not very becoming and unworthy of a robust conservative tradition.
George Will with us, his new book, The Conservative Sensibility. Well, we ran out of time to talk about baseball. We'll have you come back on, because one of the things I wanted to ask you about is African-Americans in baseball and the decline of representation, because
we know exactly why that is. It is the fact that because baseball has become so specialized at the youth level, travel teams and all the rest, it's become very expensive, requiring lots of parental time, and it does skew, therefore, toward the affluent, and it's a darn shame.
It's a huge cultural change in the game and a big loss without more African Americans in the stands and on the field of play. George Will, thank you. Good to have you with us.
I enjoyed this very much.
Thank you. The Conservative Sensibility, George Will, and in addition to his writing, his syndicated column that continues, you can see him on NBC and MSNBC programs with political commentary. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in a minute. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up later on Air Talk, we're going to focus on charter schools, legislation in Sacramento, which would give local districts more latitude to deny petitions for charters. Charter school supporters say that may be the death knell for their alternative form of public school. We'll hear the pros and cons later, but first, to show you we're very up to date in the 5 minutes since I just billboarded what was to come with state legislation on that fund for wildfire damage liability. It was passed. So the bill now goes to Governor Newsom, who proposed this $21 billion liability fund. He's expected to sign it tomorrow. With us with the latest details, Los Angeles Times, Sacramento-based reporter Taryn Lunesh, who's right outside the Capitol building. Taryn, thanks very much. So how was the vote on this?
The vote was
very strongly in favor of the proposal. 63-8 was the floor vote, and they only needed 54 to pass it.
So it was not a tight vote at all. This does, despite the fact the critics were concerned it was a bailout for the utilities?
Critics have been concerned that it was a bailout for the utilities, and you heard a little bit of that in the debate on the floor. I mean, one legislator talked about how it's hard for him to see this as anything other than a reward for monstrous behavior and that the state really needed to prioritize safety. But you heard a lot from other legislators who were concerned that if they didn't act this year and we saw more utilities file for bankruptcy or saw credit ratings downgrades, that costs would increase even greater for customers of the utilities in California.
What about the ability of cities to purchase parts of private companies like PG&E and establish municipal utilities? I know that was one of the things that they were talking about. Does this bill prohibit cities from acquiring assets of the private companies to do that?
It doesn't seem like it prohibits the companies from doing that, but it does make it harder because it requires some more approval by state state regulators before they can go off and sell the equipment. It was something that you saw several big city Bay Area mayors speak to and raise some concerns with this week. And in turn, you saw some state legislators who represent those areas either lay off the bill or vote against it.
Where is the money coming from for the $21 billion fund?
So there's actually two different models. One model would be less, with about $10.5 billion strictly from ratepayers through an increase or an extension of a charge on their utility bills for another 10-plus years. The other model would take that $10.5 billion from ratepayers and double it with another $10.5 billion from utilities. They would have to put that money up over the next several years, with about $7.5 billion from the utilities coming in the next year, and then more annually over time.
So that would essentially come from the shareholders in those publicly traded utilities.
Right. And again, it would be a match from what's coming from ratepayers. Legislators have really tried to say this wasn't an increase in rates because it's just going to extend a rate that would sunset next year.
And what about the ability of companies like PG&E or Southern California Edison to increase their rates in anticipation of fires that could be attributed to their equipment? Are they still limited in the amounts of increases that they can pass on to customers in anticipation of that?
The regulatory process doesn't really allow them to pass off costs in anticipation. You have to go through a process in which it's determined that the utility either didn't act reasonably to prevent the fire or straight up behaved negligently. And then in those instances, those increases could be blocked. But otherwise, they typically have been allowed to be passed on to ratepayers. One thing that what lawmakers are really grabbing onto in this bill is it says that PG&E has to exit its bankruptcy by next year without increasing rates on customers. So they're hopeful that that will prevent increases that otherwise would have happened as a result from the bankruptcy.
And was that the most given reason for supporting this by the governor and other advocates like Chris Holden, that if they didn't do this, that then there was no way for the companies to get out of bankruptcy?
That's one of the major things. I mean, we saw the ratings agencies this year put a lot of pressure on the state governor and the legislature. I mean, some were likening it to a gun to the head, right? They told them that they didn't pass something by July 12th, which is tomorrow, they would lower the credit ratings for SDG&E and Southern California Edison. That, in turn, could make borrowing costs and their access to capital go up, which is often allowed to be passed on to ratepayers. So anytime they wanted to borrow money, it would cost more because their ratings were lower. And then again, ratepayers would have to pick up that increase in cost. So there was those concerns as well. There's also concern that if you don't do anything this year, we see these ratings decline actually happen. And then you have a big wildfire in Southern California Edison territory, which is much of Southern California, that Edison could also file for bankruptcy. And then we'd have a problem in the state with our two largest utilities in bankruptcy. So you heard a lot of concerns about what could happen if they didn't do it, as well as some comments about how they thought this would protect ratepayers from higher increases as a result of bankruptcies, as well as the general idea that the bill requires the companies to exit, I'm sorry, PG&E to exit bankruptcy without increasing costs on ratepayers and settling their claims from 2017 and 18 wildfires. So the hope was that wildfire victims would be paid out and it would protect ratepayers. Of course, all of this is kind of yet to be determined until we see it in real life.
Taryn, thank you so much for walking us through the complexities of this, even for a bill in Sacramento. This is a highly complex one, and you've done a great job of laying out all the moving pieces of it. Thank you for taking the time, because I know you're working on updating your story on Deadline. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Appreciate it. LA Times Sacramento-based reporter Taryn Luna joining us on Air Talk. Also with us is Michael Aguirre, who is a San Diego-based attorney who represents utility customers in a case pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, having to do with the petition San Diego Gas and Electric filed with the nation's high court. Mr. Aguirre, thank you for being with us. Why do you think the legislature made a mistake here?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the utilities are a prime source of political contributions for the legislature. So the legislature needs to keep the utilities financially healthy so that the utilities can continue to finance the campaigns of a vast majority of the members of the legislature. There's strict rules already in place that say that if a utility violates those safety rules, they cannot recover uninsured damages. That's what happened when we tried the case against San Diego Gas and Electric, and the administrative law judges found that they violated safety rules in the 2007 fires, and so they had to forego $379 million for uninsured damages. And now what's happened is the governor's wiped all that out. The rates will automatically go up. If there's a new wildfire, the rates will automatically go up. They get rolled. Those new rates provide the payments for the new bonds that will be issued by the Department of Water Resources, which means now the state of California and the taxpayers are going to have to stand behind an unlimited amount of increases in the wildfires. I estimate it's going to be somewhere between $225 to $250 billion over the next 15 years. Instead of going to the utilities and saying, you must stop the wildfires, we're not giving you any more money until you stop the wildfires, and going to the institutional investors and telling them we need them to put the pressure on management to change to start providing safe electricity, and to tell the rating agencies that the kind of extortion that their practices that they're engaged in cahoots with the utilities and the institutional investors, that's the same thing that was done that forced the Congress to do the 2008 bailout. Those kinds of extortionate tactics should be investigated because it's not a proper thing to tell the state of California that unless you give us what we want, which is the huge bailout, we're going to downgrade. And if they did downgrade and they went into bankruptcy, nothing would happen because you cannot end services. You cannot use bankruptcy to end electricity services. There's specific laws that prohibit.
All right. We're talking with Michael Aguirre, San Diego-based attorney who represents plaintiffs in a case against San Diego Gas and Electric over wildfire costs from 2007, massive fires there. Also with me from the California Independent Energy Producers Association, CEO Jan Smutney-Jones. Mr. Smutney-Jones, thank you for being with us. First of all, your response to what Mr. Aguirre just said, that there wouldn't be a downside to bankruptcy for the customers of these electricity companies.
No, actually, there's a significant downside of bankruptcy to the customers of these utilities. Right now, PG&E is in bankruptcy. People who are victims of their wildfires are what's called unsecured creditors. So they are in a pool of money that may or may not materialize, and their damages may, what they recover may be fractions of what they actually lost. I think the importance of this bill is critical, and I thought Ms. Luna from the LA Times did a very good job of sort of laying it out. What this bill does do is it does create mechanisms to address safety, very specific standards, and in a process where fire experts in the Natural Resources Agency will be developing various criteria that the utilities must comply with going forward to prevent future wildland fires. It basically comes up with a better definition of prudent manager standards, and this is important because there's something called inverse condemnation that is at the heart of what this financial instability of the investor-owned utilities are facing. And by the way, this inverse condemnation also applies to publicly owned utilities such as Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, Glendale, Burbank, etc. Hopefully we can get into more of that in just a few minutes. And then most importantly, this stabilizes the financial situation for the investor-owned utilities. I think, as was indicated by Ms. Luna of the LA Times, a credit downgrade means your rates go up. A bankruptcy will end up with your rates going up. Doing nothing results in your rates going up. So there is no magic money here. And it, it is important that the legislature moved forward on this today. I think we should be proud of our government being able to address this in a bipartisan manner. This was a tough vote for them. But there's, over 30,000 homes destroyed over the last couple of years. I think it's 139 people have died in these fires. So this is something that's affecting all of us. It's a big deal. And I think my hat's off to both the governor and the legislature for trying to take a leadership role on this. And I will point out there is a lot more work to be done in other areas. So this is not over with. This is just an important step.
At the heart of Mr. Aguirre's critique is that there's nothing here to require the electricity companies end their negligent practices when it comes to maintaining their equipment and transmission lines, the things that led to these catastrophic fires in the first place. Can you respond to that contention that this really isn't holding the companies accountable for the kind of maintenance and safety measures they need to take?
Two things. One thing is I think Mr. Aguirre is wrong in that contention. But more importantly, you use the word negligence. And what's going on with respect to utility equipment, the wires, and that's really what we're talking about that causes fires, a utility, whether they're a privately owned utility like Southern California Edison or a public utility like Los Angeles Department of Power, are strictly liable for fires that result from the operation of their equipment. That's the interpretation of our Constitution by our courts here in California. That's called inverse condemnation. So if their electrical property that's committed for the public good, all of us, because we all use that grid, causes a fire, they're strictly liable regardless of their negligence. So this bill does have, lays out a new safety structure, basically to put experts in charge of basically making sure that they are meeting these criteria. They will be required, in order to access any of these funds, to have a valid safety certificate. If they don't have one of those safety certificates, they're not, they can't access these funds. And these funds, by the way, are designed to basically equitably and expeditiously basically help wildfire victims in short order. So I don't think it's leaving anybody off the hook. There is a great deal of activity already taking place under legislation that was enacted last year to do various types of preventative measures with respect to wildland fires.
Okay.
Everybody is taking this very seriously.
Let me raise a listener question with you. Belinda writes on our AirTalk page, "It's time to take utilities out of private hands. We are paying for poor management and subsidizing private profits. One might object by saying large governmental agencies are inefficient, but those governmental agencies aren't burning citizens. We have the worst of both worlds from private utilities. Let's at least stop paying top dollar for such abysmal abysmal service. Jan Smutney-Jones, your response to the contention that it would be better if all of the electricity provided in California came from public nonprofit agencies.
I'm not sure that helps at all. And as a matter of fact, there's a case right now in Northern California, a small public utility district in Trinity County had a wildland fire. It's very small. They only have like an annual budget of about $12 million a year. It's probably 20 people that work for them. And they burned down about 20,000 acres and destroyed some property in Trinity County. They're having this exact same problem with inverse condemnation. Their ratepayers are on the hook. As I said earlier, if LADWP has a fire, and I pray to God they don't, you as being ratepayers in L.A. would be strictly liable for that fire as well. So my own utility here in Sacramento, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, is a world leader in green energy. They have very properly maintained their rights of way for transmission lines into the Sierras. They're on credit watch, okay? So they got affected by all this as well. So the municipalization of the transmission system is not a panacea.
Okay. Jan Smutney-Jones with us, California's Independent Energy Producers Association. Back to attorney Michael Aguirre, based in San Diego, who represents customers in a case against San Diego Gas and Electric filed with the U.S. Supreme Court. So what's next? Governor Newsom is expected signs this tomorrow. Then what sort of recourse do you see it having for ratepayers?
Well, may I just say this? If think about this for a second. Right now, San Diego Gas and Electric was not permitted to recover $400 million of uninsured coverage because of the 2007 fire, because we showed that they violated the existing safety rules, which are put into something called General Order 95. So we already have that in place. We already have a very specific example of a utility not showing that it was prudent and disallowing the money. So there's no need to do all these other things except to create the opportunity for the utilities to push their liabilities onto the ratepayers. So what's going to happen next is this. The idea that you're going to extend a rate and change it from paying for the excessive priced electricity that we did in 2001 when that rate was put into place, and you're just going to extend that through the legislature, we'll be challenging that in Northern District Court, Northern District of California Federal Court, because they're violating the taking provisions of the Fifth Amendment, because only the CPUC can impose a rate. Otherwise, it's a tax. So the legislature is acting illegally when they do that. Number two, they're attempting to change the prudency rule. The prudency rule has been in effect in California since 80 years.
What is it?
It basically says that before the utility can get your money, they have to show they acted reasonably. So in the case of San Diego Gas and Electric, they sought $400 million. We had a trial, and the administrative law judges, the Fourth Appellate District, the California Supreme Court all ruled in our favor and said, hey, SDG&E, you didn't prove you acted reasonably, so you're going to have to pick it up. Now, what happened to SDG&E? SDG&E then changed all their practices. SDG&E hasn't had a fire in 10 years, but PG&E ignored it. Southern California Edison ignored it. They didn't change their practices. And what they're saying now, particularly PG&E, is don't make us live by the rules. Just bail us out, put all the incentives in favor of more wildfires, and things will be okay.
Michael Aguirre, I need to wrap, but thank you for being with us, San Diego-based attorney. My thanks to Jan Smutney-Jones, California's Independent Energy Producers Association, and Taryn Luna of the Los Angeles Times. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about legislation in California which could significantly limit charter school creation and some of the terms in their freedom to operate. We'll hear the pros and cons in 1 minute. Got a couple of big in-person events coming up at KPCC, and I sure hope you'll join me for them. The first is a week from tomorrow. It's next Friday when we pay tribute to the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing and the first walk on the moon. We'll have a wonderful panel of guests joining us live for our 10 o'clock hour of Air Talk that day, right here at our Crawford Family Forum at KPECC. Please join us. The event is, of course, free, but you can make your reservation. We ask that you do so at kpecc.org/in-person. Once again, the date of that is Friday, the 19th of July, a week from tomorrow, our Crawford Family Forum, the 10 o'clock hour of Air Talk, right here at KPECC. Also, on July 27th, Saturday night, I'll be at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. That beautiful historic movie palace began life as United Artists Flagship Theater. I'll be there showing Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights on the big screen at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Afterwards, we'll be having a freewheeling fun conversation about everything from the making of the film to the nature of the adult movie business as it transitioned to home video. That's what's at the heart of Boogie Nights. The film has plenty of adult content and nudity. It's for adults only, but we'd love to have you there at the Theater at Ace Hotel, Saturday night, July 27th. 7 p.m. Tickets are available at kpecc.org/in-person. Well, the California Teachers Association, coming off a very successful strike in Los Angeles and the growing cloud of teachers across the country, is hoping to see legislation pass in Sacramento, which reigns in charter schools. There are a number of different proposals that have to do with teacher credentialing and have to do with the latitude local districts have to allow for the creation or the blocking of charter schools. With us to talk about the bills, Louis Friedberg, executive director of EdSource, the nonprofit journalism publication. Louis, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So let's start first with the bill that would limit, or I should say, would allow local districts to limit charter school creation. How is that stacking up?
Well, this is still a matter that's very much in process right now. It's Assembly Bill 1505. There was a big hearing a couple of days ago on this. And basically, the governor's office is very much involved in this. They're trying to reach a consensus between the folks who are very critical of charter schools and charter school supporters. And reaching a consensus is being quite challenging. One of the big issues was whether, and remains, whether a school district can take into account the financial impact that opening new charter schools would have on the district. And in the latest proposal that's on the table, that the governor, governor's office wants to make it limit a little bit more what was in the original bill. So that under the current proposal, it's still allowed to take financial impact into account, but a little more difficult. It would also, for in school districts that are really in financial distress and can show that they are in financial distress, the school district would be allowed to not issue new authorizations for charter schools. That would affect school districts like Oakland, potentially Inglewood, and I suppose also Los Angeles, where, as you know, this is just a huge issue, and LA has more charter schools than any district in the country.
Well, it's kind of ironic, though, Louis, because the districts that are in financial distress, supporters of charter schools would probably argue part of the reason for the financial distress is that the schools have been underperforming. And so if you say, well, because they're in financial straits, they can block charters from being created, the charters would undoubtedly argue that's going to penalize parents who are then forced to send their kids to substandard schools.
Well, precisely, Larry, you've put your finger on just how complex this issue is. You know, the fact is that if more kids are enrolling in charter schools, it's fewer kids that a school district has to serve, but there's overhead costs and that the school district still has to cover. And it does put some pressure on the finances of the school district. And so then if they have to make additional cuts, that's going to hurt the kids in that school district, even though the ones going to charter schools might benefit from the charter school. So it's an enormously complicated issue. And we'll just have to see how this plays itself out. I mean, at the moment, the Charter School Association is not supporting this compromise measure, and the California Teachers Association is.
Lewis, what you mentioned that they've done some tweaking on the issue of financial impact on a district if a charter is created. I mean, if you took that just at the pure level, I would think the creation of any charter would have a financial effect because the average daily attendance reimbursement from the state to the local school district, it would not go to the district-run school. It would go to the charter-run public school. So that would just de facto seem to give any district a right to block a charter because there would be a fiscal impact. But how is that mitigated in the tweaked proposal?
So some of the things that the tweaked proposal says that the school district could take into account things like a charter school would be, and I'm just quoting from the bill, it says demonstrably unlikely to serve the interests of the school district. And that could be based on two factors. For example, whether the proposed charter school would duplicate the program already offered by neighborhood schools. And it also says it would extend to a proposed charter school that would, and a quote again, would substantially undermine a district services programs or academic offerings. So, and this is, of course, would be open to some interpretation. But the school district would really have to make the case as to, and show why it would undermine a district services programs or academic offerings. So it would seem it's trying to get around a district just arbitrarily saying, oh yeah, this has a financial impact. They would have to demonstrate it. And also, you know, with school districts that are really under tremendous financial stress, they would have to demonstrate that, I believe, an organization like FICMAT, the Fiscal Control Management Assistant Team, would have to say, yeah, this school district is under stress.
Lewis, I need to break, but I just wanted to ask you another quick question. Is the legislation still alive that would require that all of the charter teachers be credentialed as they are in district-run public schools?
That is still in the bill, but basically, just to clarify, charter schools do have to have credentialed teachers. This just refers to kind of in the core subjects. This just refers to other kind of classes, music classes, art classes, dance classes, and so on, where in regular public schools you do need credentialed teachers, and this does not extend to charter schools. So that's where the discussion or the debate is at this point.
So you could have at a charter school, let's say a music professional who doesn't have a credential, come in and teach a class. You couldn't do that in a district school. It would have to be a credentialed music teacher.
Yeah, and of course the argument is, you know, you can be a great pianist, but that doesn't make you a good teacher necessarily. So this is, again, also a complex issue.
We're talking with Lewis Friedberg of EdSource. He's executive director of the nonprofit journalism publication focusing on education issues, mostly here in California, but national ed issues as well. Coming up, we'll talk with State Senator Nancy Skinner, a co-author of AB 1505 on charters, hear what she has to say. And we'll talk with Myrna Castrojón, who's the president and CEO of the California Charter Schools Association. They oppose AB 1505. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. We'll be back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurtis. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. One of the subject areas that garners tremendous listener input is charter schools. Highly divisive issue. We're talking about legislation in Sacramento, which would change the criteria for local school districts to approve or deny the opening of charters within their districts. The bill would also mandate that all of the teachers that are hired by charters be credentialed, as is the case in district-run public schools. themselves. Currently, as we just heard from Louis Friedberg of EdSource, there's the requirement that in the core subject areas, the charters have credentialed teachers, but in non-core subject areas like the arts, music, etc., they can use people might have professional experience, interest in it, to have aptitude, but who are not credentialed to teach those subject areas in charters. What do you think about this bill and the ways that it allows districts to have more control over charter opening and operation and the restrictions on hiring that it would create in local charters? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is State Senator Nancy Skinner, Democrat from the Berkeley area, co-author of AB 1505. Senator Skinner, thank you for being with us.
Certainly. Thank you.
How, you know, for those that support the creation of charters, what do you say to them that allowing districts to consider the financial impact on state funding that they get allows them to deny the opening of charters, even if it's in the best interests of students in the district?
My Senate district, Senate District 9, is in the East Bay. You mentioned Berkeley, but in fact, I have the entire swath of the I-80 corridor, including Oakland, Richmond, San Leandro, Alameda, other communities like that. Two of my school districts, Oakland and Richmond, have been in state receivership, and both are struggling financially. And both of these school districts also have a very high percentage of low-income students, students with English that is not their first language, many, many, many challenges. And they've also experienced a significant rise in charters. And the increase of charters and the reduction of students who are served directly by our public schools has had a very serious financial impact on both of those districts.
Have both of those districts closed campuses, cut the amount of administration, cut their costs overall as their student population has dropped to respond to that? Or are they still trying to keep all those campuses open with fewer students?
Both districts have had to close schools, and this has a serious impact, because let me take Oakland Unified for a minute. And first, there is a think tank based in Oakland, Public Interest, that did a study on Oakland Unified's finances, because not only have they been in state receivership, now they have a huge deficit. The legislature last year had to do a bill that assisted not only Oakland Unified, but also Inglewood. Anyway, that think tank estimated that the financial loss to Oakland Unified School District due to charters was $57.3 million a year. That was the impact on the ability of OUSD to be able to provide the quality education that all of us expect for our public school students and all of our school students. The other real challenge to Oakland when they have to close a school is Oakland does not have the financial resources to provide bus service for their students. So having neighborhood-based schools is really important for those low-income students to be able to get to school, because there's not school transportation offered to them. So each time we have had to close a school, we see a reduction in attendance, because those students are stuck. They can't get to school. So often, if there's a charter closer to them, they'll end up at the charter, not necessarily because the parent preferred it, but because that's the only school their child can walk to.
We're talking with State Senator Nancy Skinner of the East Bay area. A Democrat is co-author of AB 1505. Also with us, the president and CEO of the California Charter Schools Association, Myrna Castrejon. Ms. Castrejon, thank you for being with us again. What about the point that we just heard from Senator Skinner that these districts, many of them have gotten in severe financial trouble because they've lost students to charters, and it's going to be tough for them to survive if they allow more charters to be created?
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for having me. There's no question that there are districts that are under severe financial distress. across California. And the senator has cited the study from In the Public Interest. I think there's certainly some questions, some real questions about the methodology for arriving at that 57 million. But what's more, actually more important to point out right now is the very recently released a grand jury report, which basically pointed to the chronic challenge that Oakland Unified has had in mismanagement of its finances and its resources, and an endemic culture of underperformance at all levels of administration that have exacerbated those challenges. But there's no question that the entire state of California is dealing with the challenges of declining enrollment overall. We see that in Los Angeles as well. But it's also true, and the governor's task force looked at some of those districts and issues. You're absolutely right to point out that the question of how districts manage those externalities has a lot more to do with the financial standing or a lot bigger impact on the financial standing of those districts than charter schools themselves. In fact, there was a recent report from the Center for Reinventing Public Education that specifically looked at this issue and showed that when you look at all of the districts in California, the average share of charter school enrollment actually does not significantly differ across school districts based on their financial status. And we lived through Measure EE just recently here in Los Angeles, right, where we actually joined the coalition as the charter community in support of the passage of greater resources, raising partial taxes here in Los Angeles. But there's a really, really deeply felt and substantiated concern from the public about how districts manage their resources to accommodate all of these issues that actually ultimately don't get into the issue of charter schools. And ultimately, the issue that you identified at the top is whether or not our students are actually being served well.
Ms. Castrejon, if the bill was passed, AB 1505, would you anticipate that school districts, when charters came up for their renewal, would choose to deny them because of the loss of students and revenue to the district? Do you anticipate that you would see a gradual closing of charters? Or do you think that there's so much support for the schools that are already open that they would be able to lobby and to survive the renewal process?
Well, I think that varies from community to community. Certainly, we know that our charter families have been incredibly motivated to advocate strongly for protective measures that would help us navigate this very difficult moment that really got kicked off with the strikes across the state. And there's been a sustained campaign to try to peg the issues of fiscal distress of districts when we know that the issue is so much more complicated than this on charters and charter existence and charter growth. So yes, I'm definitely concerned, and our families are concerned, that taken as a whole, the combination of the provisions of 1505 and 1507 actually will result in the closure of schools, existing schools, not just curtailing the possibility for new schools to emerge across the state in California.
We'll take listener calls coming up. What do you think about the legislation co-authored by our guest, State Senator Nancy Skinner of the East San Francisco Bay Area, which would allow school districts to take into account certain duplication of programs that might be presented with a new charter, or that in some way undermine what the school district itself is trying to accomplish with its schools? It would enable those districts to block the opening of new charters, potentially turn down the renewal of charters when they come up for review. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Back in a minute. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up in just a few minutes. Guest will be from the New York Times national immigration reporter Caitlin Dickerson, whose reporting has included how immigrant children have been housed at the Border Patrol station in Clint, Texas. and also a look at the Trump administration's immigration policies. That's Fresh Air coming up next on KPCC. Tomorrow, Film Week comes your way at 11, as it does every Friday. We'll have a release, a review, I should say, of the new release Stuber, the action comedy, also the horror film Crawl, and The Farewell, a drama that stars Awkwafina from Crazy Rich Asians, where she had such a strong showing. That's Film Week tomorrow at 11 right here on 89.3 KPECC. Right now, we're talking about charter schools and AB 1505, which would allow local school districts to have more latitude in denying the approval of charters. The bill, as currently constituted, would also require that all of the teaching staff at charters be credentialed. Currently, they have to be credentialed in core subject areas, but not in some of the non-core like music and the arts. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Spencer, in South Los Angeles, what do you think?
Hi, my name is Spencer Burrows, and I am on the board of directors of Teach Public Schools, and we're a network of an elementary school, a middle school, and a high school. So how 1505 specifically would impact us, we find it pretty troubling about the financial impact provision that would allow for the denial of a petition. As Senator Glaser pointed out in the Senate hearing yesterday, he brought up that what happens in the next economic downturn in our state when there's going to be many more school districts that are heavily impacted, and does that mean that every charter petition is going to be denied based on the clear financial impact because the district's already in distress, I think is a major issue worth discussing.
All right, Spencer, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Daisy in Studio City. What do you think? Daisy, are you there? All right, she's not there. Let's talk with Kirsten in Playa Vista. Your opinion of AB 1505.
Hi, I'm strongly opposed to the measure. My son goes to a public school, so but the problem is until public schools are able to better serve the entire community, there are a lot of kids that I know who they have exhausted all their resources that they could within the public school system, and they ended up being better served in charters. And so I understand the concerns about certain charters that may not be up to snuff, but there are really good charters out there that are actually serving people in the community that are not otherwise served right now.
What are you at all concerned, though, that as more and more charters open and receive the public funding that would have in the past gone to district operated schools, that that's over time going to starve the district schools? And for the kids, for whatever reason, you know, whose parents don't get them into the charters, who are ones for whatever reason might be discouraged going to a charter, they're going to be left behind. What do you think of that argument?
I think that we can do two things at the same time. I think we can, which is what I try to do, strengthen our public school system in every means possible, but also not take away the schools that are actually doing well and helping out the kids that are not being currently helped in the public school system. I think it's a really bad idea to go after charters first before we fix all the other problems. Again, like I said, I support public schools 100%, and I look forward to the day that charters are not necessary as a stopgap measure, but at this point, that's actually what a lot of charters are providing is
okay.
An alternative.
Kirsten, thank you for your call. We now have Daisy in Studio City. Daisy, you wanted to talk about the universal requirement for teacher credentialing for charters that's contained in this bill. And you're opposed to that requirement for all teachers to have credentials. Why?
Yes, I am. I am both a charter parent and an LAUSD parent. Charters have to do more with less. We receive somewhere between $2,500 and $3,000 less per student in funding from the government. Our charter has managed to outperform LAUSD in all the core subjects, and we have a vibrant music, art, and gardening program because we are able to get professionals who come and work with us to supplement their main income. And once credentialing is required for music, art, gardening, et cetera, we will not be able to afford those people or those programs.
Daisy, I appreciate your call. Senator Nancy Skinner, you want to respond to that?
Well, I wanted to respond to some of the previous comments in that. So I don't think it would be appropriate to say that charters in general have are why our schools across the state may be struggling financially. We got to remember that California is still 45th in per pupil funding nationally, and very recently we were 47th, 49th. So we definitely need to do better. But I still feel that we should give our local school districts, who we all elect, and remind everyone that our school districts are elected, the ability to make decisions that will benefit all of our children. And the benefit of AB 1505 is that allows the school district to be able to factor real impacts on the district in any decision that they make. And certainly, any fear that districts would just uniformly reject charters or non-renewal, these are elected school boards. They are going to be responsive to their communities. I would only anticipate rejections of charters or renewals where it really was demonstrated that it was financially impacting the community.
You know, some of the districts, as you know, though, in the state, the members of the school board, their biggest financial backing has come from teachers' unions. So in many cases, they are going to feel an obligation to the interests of the district teachers.
They still have to be elected by their local citizens, and school districts have a lot fewer voters than Senate districts, where I have a million.
Thank you so much, Senator Nancy Skinner of the East San Francisco Bay Area, a co-author of AB 1505. My thanks to the CEO and president of the California Charter Schools Association, Mirna Castrejon, and to Louis Friedberg, who's the executive director of the nonprofit journalism site EdSource. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air is coming up next. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for Air Talk, and 11, it's Film Week on KPCC.